League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20.
Hello and welcome to the Sci Guys, the show where we talk about the crazy, weird, and wonderful stories from the science world. I'm Corey, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Luke Cutford.
Hello!
This week, we're talking about something odd.
Okay, very nondescript.
But first, we're doing a little Apple review. So
no, that felt wrong.
But first, we're doing a Wii review.
You didn't have to do it again.
I did do it again. Look, what do you want from me? Look, the review says I'm doing it. It's 5 stars. It says, I recently found this podcast and now I'm just listening through all the episodes to catch up. Listening to episode 83 and they just told me I don't count. Great podcast. Would recommend 10 times out of 10.
I'm sorry for telling you you don't count. Hopefully, by the time you catch up to this episode, we'll say that you matter very much.
You still can't count, though.
But you didn't for the last 80 episodes or so.
I have no idea what the context of that is as well. Like, we say a lot of stuff on this podcast.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is nonsense. But this is not nonsense. This is a question. I have a question for everyone listening and watching. If you're listening on Apple or on Spotify even, head over to YouTube, get down to the comments and answer this question. The question is, what is your pet peeve?
I don't really think I have a pet peeve.
Really? That makes sense, though. You're a very unpeevable person.
Okay, I think my pet peeve, I would say, is when people are talking, but they're sort of dancing around a point, and they don't even really know the point they're trying to make. And some of the stuff they say sort of doesn't make sense of the other stuff they say. This happened like the other day. So maybe it's a short term pet peeve. And I just sort of stopped the conversation and went, look, just say what you need to say. I will not be offended if you just be direct. And we're all friends here.
The few times you have complained to me about something, it has been about something like that.
Oh, God, I have the other one. Sorry.
Yeah, go for it.
The other one is when I ask a person a piece of information that is like maybe a sentence long and they tell me a story instead. I'm like, I didn't ask for a story. I want the information, on the answer to my question. Because I spend the whole time trying to decode the information I asked for, and I'm not really listening to the story. I just want the information.
See, my pet peeve is actually kind of similar to yours. I really don't like when I'm given information that I already know. So I research stuff when I'm ill. So if I go to the GP and they start telling me all about this illness that I got, I get really antsy because I already know it. And I'm just like, yeah, come on, let's go. Let's get to the stuff I don't know.
Yeah.
If I'm in a conversation with someone and they start telling me all about this thing that I already know, I'm just like, uh-huh.
Have you ever heard of a thing called theory of mind? The other person does not know what you know, Corey.
No, I know that they don't know that I know it.
I know, I just told you a thing you already know.
Yeah, I know. I know that. But the issue is that, like, how do you politely express to someone, stop telling me this,
yeah,
I already know?
It is very difficult.
It's so hard. There are very few ways to socially acceptable ways to do that. And it bugs me to no end. let's just start the episode.
Yeah, let's start the show.
So today's episode isn't exactly about pet peeves. I kind of brought that up because it's related to, I guess, getting irritated at things. That's one part of what we're talking about today. So I said today's episode was about something that was odd. That was something that wouldn't make sense verbally. But if you're reading it, it's going to make a lot of sense. We're talking about oppositional defiant disorder today. Have you heard of that?
Goodness me, no. Oppositional defiant disorder. Is this like a condition where you just... Is it like devil, like constant devil's advocacy? You just, every single time anybody says anything, you are always oppositional to it.
No, do you know what? Kind of. But it's only found... It's only sort of diagnosed in a very specific subset of people. Can you guess what those people are? Or what kind of people they are?
Against.
Oh my god!
Sorry. I just wanted to. No, I mean, no, I cannot, other than dickheads.
Children.
Hey.
Children.
Some Luke. Children are dickheads.
That's very true. But this is actually. You say that. I think that's kind of what I want to talk about a little bit later.
Some children are dickheads.
Well, some children are, yes. But what I'm saying more is that oppositional defiant disorder is. It's interesting. It's kind of almost pathologizing a kid being perceived as a dad. Yeah,
right.
Yeah, which, and you know, look, if you're getting upset or annoyed at what I'm saying, I will elaborate. Look, I'll elaborate later. I'm not saying that having ODD makes you that kind of person. It's more complex than that, and it's kind of interesting. But first, we need to understand what ODD is. So here are the symptoms. I'll just list them off. Being unusually angry and irritable, frequently losing your temper, being easily annoyed, arguing with authority figures, refusing to follow rules, deliberately annoying people, blaming others for mistakes, and being vindictive. Now, obviously, if you're reading this and you know a child or an adolescent, you might be thinking, yeah, they do this a lot. Now, I know that kids and teenagers do this a lot, that is true, but when you do it too much and you do it like all the time, that's when it starts verging into ODD territory, right? It's one of those situations, again, in that, yes, everyone feels sad sometimes, and yes, everyone loses focus sometimes, but that doesn't mean that everyone has depression or ADHD.
Quick question. So you've said here, firstly, I felt very bad about calling these people dickheads until you got to the end of there and you said being vindictive, and I was like, okay. Because a lot of the other stuff is like, I can understand why that would be a behavioral thing in somebody who's traumatized, for example, or somebody who's had a very difficult life or has grown up in certain circumstances where being kind is not rewarded and you have to sort of fend for yourself. Mm-hmm. Absolutely understand how that could happen. But then being vindictive, it feels like vindictive almost by definition is unnecessary and mean.
I think you got to remember that this is only, as far as I'm aware, only diagnosed in children.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they then usually grow out of it. So you don't really see... As far as I'm aware, from what I've been reading, it seems that you don't really see adults with ODD.
Yeah.
It's something that's diagnosed in children. And we could talk a little bit more about why that is later.
Yeah. Can I just ask quickly? So you've sort of described like how, yes, some children or many children or many teenagers or whatever, they'll be vindictive sometimes, they'll be rude sometimes, mm-hmm. they'll question authority sometimes. But when it becomes a constant thing, this is when it's ODD.
Yeah.
Is this a case of like a scale thing? Like it's and you pass a threshold, and some people can be slightly under that threshold and aren't diagnosed, aren't pathologized as ODD, and some people exceed that threshold and then they're ODD. Or is it like the actual truth of the misunderstanding of, say, autism, where everyone says, well, everyone's on the spectrum somewhere. And actually, they aren't. You're either on the spectrum or you're not. And then there's a spectrum within that spectrum. Yeah. And so is it a scale thing and so, everyone's on the scale and some people pass the threshold? Or is it you're on the scale of ODD or you're not?
Yeah, I think it's, to me at least, it seems like it's more of a scale that everyone is on. Because from what I've gathered reading about this, it doesn't seem as though ODD is a thing in and of itself. You know, it seems like it's just sort of maladaptive behavior.
Yeah.
In the same sense that anxiety is, anxiety is a normal and healthy thing. You should feel anxious sometimes. That is perfectly healthy. If you never feel anxious, there's probably something wrong with you. That sounds really bad.
But you have a really lovely life.
Yeah, right? Yeah. But then even then, even if you have the best life, it'd be weird if you never felt anxiety at any point. And anxiety can help you in a number of ways when it's targeted and healthy.
Are you going to pathologize not feeling anxious?
Yeah, I'm going to pathologize anything.
Look
at me.
You weirdo. You have a lovely life and you never feel anxious? That must be some kind of disorder. Let's stick that in the DSM-5.
All you need to do is make an
anxiety disorder.
Yeah. AAD. You just make an acronym and suddenly it's a thing. No, but what I mean is that anxiety is a natural thing, you know? There's a reason that we feel anxious in the same sense that there's a reason that we feel sad. There's a reason that we feel happy. There's a reason that we not necessarily feel mania, but we feel, you know, yeah, some of those things that when amplified become mania.
Yeah.
There is a reason for all of those things. And it's when those things become out of control that we start saying, that's a disorder, that's a disorder, that's a disorder, that's a disorder. In the case of ODD, it seems like it's more akin to anxiety and depression than, say, autism or even potentially ADHD, you know, sort of neurodivergent situation. It's less of an on-off and more of a, as you say, sort of a scale, a gradient.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And moving on from that, and I've got a quote here. It says, another hallmark of ODD is the toll it takes on family relationships. Regular daily frustrations, ignored commands, arguments, explosive outbursts build up over time, and these negative interactions damage the parent-child bond and reinforce hostile patterns of behavior. So from that quote, you can kind of understand that it's not just about, you know, the child's behavior. It's about how that behavior then affects the entire family unit. And again, it's like reading the DSM-5. It's only a disorder when it starts to impact your social or professional or educate, you know, like your academic life. That's when those issues become disorders. Obviously, there are other criteria as well, but that is one of the criteria, you know? So moving on from that, I want to talk a little bit about the prevalence. So as I said, it's usually diagnosed in children. And when I say usually, I'm pretty sure it's only diagnosed in children. So it says here, the normal course of ODD is not well defined. Like, we don't really understand a huge amount about how it develops and all about it in that sort of sense. There are a ton of papers on it. I mean, I think thousands per year. Well, I say thousands, over 1,000 a year for the past, you know, couple decades. That's just looking on PubMed, all of the things that have oppositional defiant disorder in the title or show up in those search results. So there are quite a few studies on it, but it's still not fully understood or even relatively well characterized.
Okay, so if it's only diagnosed in children in childhood, is there an equivalent diagnosis that you would have for an adult who is exhibiting these symptoms, or would you just be like, get some therapy?
Kind of. I mean, this is where it gets complex. So about 70%, and this is from one study, about 70% of people that had ODD symptoms, they were resolved by 18 years, by the time they became 18.
By themselves?
Not necessarily by themselves, but they were resolved by the time they turned 18.
Okay, yeah.
And this is interesting. Like, you can have it in adulthood, but it's obviously way, way, way less common. It's more common in men than it is in women, or rather it's more severe in men than it is in women.
And when you say you can have it in adulthood, obviously all of those symptoms, like the characterizations of ODD, like being vindictive, ignoring commands, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Adults can do all of those things. So are there, like, so what would there be? I know we use the word pathologizing a lot, but what circumstances there would be under which an adult would be diagnosed with ODD? Is it like if there's some kind of mental impairment that means that they aren't able to control those reflexes or impulses?
As far as I'm aware, adults don't necessarily get diagnosed with ODD. I think it's one of those situations where you carry it from childhood. And this is, I could be wrong on this. I could be absolutely wrong, but I've really struggled to find any information on diagnosing anyone that isn't a child.
Okay.
And basically all of the information you see on this is about children. It's far worse than it is for autism. You know, when you search up autism or ADHD, all of the resources you find are for parents and their kids rather than for adults, you know, looking after themselves. It's all focused on children. And ODD is like that turned up to 11. It only seems to be something that is spoken about in children. I think the reason for that is that kids obviously have less impulse control than adults. They're not as good at, you know, expressing themselves or holding their emotions inside or, you know, following social norms. When you become an adult, it becomes easier. But there are some adults that find that more difficult.
Yeah,
that
absolutely.
Are more impulsive. That kind of thing that you're pointing out there, like some kind of problem that would cause someone to be more impulsive.
Like the guy who had the Phineas Gage?
Yeah.
Is that the guy who had the rod through his face?
Yeah,
and
so
he became
his,
really horrible. Like, he became really rude.
See, that was through brain damage.
Yes, exactly.
But
I'm not saying he's to blame. But yeah, areas of his brain that controlled impulses. And you see this in older people, well, not necessarily older people, but mostly older people with, say, dementia or Alzheimer's, mm-hmm. they become rude because they swear at you, they say horrible things that they wouldn't otherwise say because they have an impulse. And then normally we have another part of our brain which sort of pushes that impulse down mm-hmm. and goes, no, we don't say things like that. But that part of their brain is sort of failing.
So I guess to answer your question of what might cause this in adults and what might cause it in kids, I would answer that with another question. What group of people, like what disorder causes a lack of impulse control or difficulties with impulse control?
ADHD.
Exactly.
Right.
Well done.
That's
yeah.
why you're so rude all the time.
Probably. Zero patience. Genuinely though, I'm incredibly impatient. That's why one of my pet peeves is being told something I've already been told, because I get so impatient.
Oh my
I cannot
gosh.
Be bothered. Wait.
Well, I'm so sorry for calling you a dickhead at the start of this episode.
No, I am. Don't get me wrong. I absolutely am. It just winds me up, because it's one of those things where, you know, there is no socially acceptable thing to say. So that impulse of just like wanting to interrupt and be like, I know, can we move on?
Yeah.
It's so hard to fight that. And I think that's probably what annoys me more than actually just receiving old information. You know, it's fighting that impulse that winds me up. But back to ODD, ADHD is incredibly comorbid with ODD. And this isn't necessarily me unraveling ODD. That's not what this episode is. I'm not trying to undermine it and say it's not a thing. This isn't the maladaptive daydreaming episode all over again. I'm not saying that I'm smarter than all of the psychiatrists, psychologists, all the people that are studying this. But to me, looking at ODD, it seems to kind of highlight one of the major problems with how we view mental health and sort of psychiatric disorders, you know? So getting back onto the sort of prevalence and the comorbidities, as I said, ADHD is super comorbid with this, but also you've got a 90% chance or a greater than 90% chance of being diagnosed with another mental illness in your lifetime if you're an adolescent or an adult with a history of ODD.
That doesn't sound surprising at all.
Right, exactly.
I would imagine that one of the reasons why somebody might have a ODD is like a traumatic or difficult upbringing, because that make, like I said earlier on, like if you grow up in an environment where being kind or is sort of seen as a weakness, then obviously you're going to naturally form a sort of more aggressive stance to life,
mm-hmm.
And you're not going to give other people as much like leniency because that was punished in you in the past.
Yeah.
So that's learned.
And yeah, and that's just one route to that. So yeah, you've got the trauma route, but you could also have the route of just someone that really struggles with impulse control and gets annoyed at things more easily than other people. And so then, and also doesn't like being told what to do. If you have all of these little, if you mix all of these together in your little cauldron, you make a person with ODD probably, right?
And I imagine also that then is sort of you're then more likely statistically to, for example, end up in jail because you know, and there's two aspects of or in prison, sorry, jail awaiting sentence,
yeah.
Prison being then what's the word, convicted of a mm-hmm. crime. But the trouble with that is that the purpose of prison is sort of twofold, or at least on the surface the suggestion of the purpose of prison is twofold. You've got the societal justice, punish the bad people type of thing, and then you've got the kind of rehabilitation. And the rehabilitation, I don't think anybody, if somebody's done something that damaged other people or hurt other people and that isn't generally socially acceptable, I think we'd all agree that we'd like some kind of system that can help people get back on a good path that isn't damaging other people or themselves.
You dirty radical. How dare you?
Well, I'm just saying, we'd all agree that at least that is quite a good thing. Right. I mean, actually, no, I think you're probably right. There are genuinely people who just go, no, punish them. I'm one of the good people, so I feel good about myself if you punish the bad people.
Yeah, once you've done something bad, there's no use for... There's nothing you can do except rot away in jail.
But if you've got a genuine impulse control thing, mm-hmm. then yes, rehabilitation might be something that would be beneficial for you, but the punishment aspect of prison, I think you could at least make an argument that you don't deserve that if you don't have the same impulse control that other people do have. It's not your fault, and it's not their good character that meant they had an effective impulse control and therefore didn't do the thing you did.
But that's what people think.
But
this reminds me of the conversation that we had with Dodie way back in the episode we did with her, the one on DPDR. Yeah,
DPRD.
Yeah, DPRD, depersonalization and derealization disorder. We've got that episode in a card. You can click on it right now and
wow.
watch it.
Wow. Look at that.
I actually have no idea which side it's on. It's somewhere.
I think it's over there.
But yeah, it reminds me of that conversation we had with Dodie where we spoke about who is actually at fault. Like, who actually deserves to go to jail? Who deserves to go to prison? Because how responsible are you for your own actions? Well, we all like to think that we're responsible for our own actions. We've got free will, but then also we're beholden to the chemistry in our brain and, you know, our upbringing and how that has impacted us. We can't all make the same choices as everyone else. For example, if you have ADHD, it is just harder for you to control those impulses. And so why is it fair that you should be beholden to the exact same rules as everyone else when everyone else has it far easier? I'm not saying that ADHD people with ADHD should be allowed to commit crimes willy-nilly, but my point is just to highlight the issues with punishment as a sort of role for prison. Prison shouldn't really be about punishment in my mind. It should all be about the rehabilitation, because ultimately, if you say it should be for punishment, then what do we gain from that as a society, other than the vindicated feeling, like the nice, good feeling of someone bad getting what's coming to them?
Theoretically, at least, we always gain the opposite thing, which is that you're trying to manufacture fear in people who haven't done the thing yet. And so, like,
just doesn't
work.
Though.
It's not just purely. I know that there is some like vindictive. I feel great because this bad person was punished, and mm-hmm. that, you know, that's very naturally in us, I think. But then also, there's the kind of like, we need to make it so that. So, for example, if you speed, if you speed. 1 in 10 people speeding get caught, say.
Yeah.
Right? And imagine you could put some theoretical cost on every time somebody sped, like the total damage caused by speeding, ignoring mm-hmm. the fact that people actually die because people speed, but the total damage of like other cars, you could somehow quantify financially the effects of speeding. If there are 10% of people get caught, well, then the cost of speeding needs to be for every person who gets caught, they have to pay 10 times more mm-hmm. than the average damage in order to rectify the fact that 90% of people don't get caught. That's an argument you could make, so that the total damage is paid by the total number of people who are caught, and that disincentivizes speeding in a sort of game theoretical sort of way. Whether people actually think, what I mean is, there's a solid logical theory.
I agree.
Whether it works and whether actually do people pay attention to it. Like, there's a lot of studies that suggest that certainty of capture rather than severity of punishment is more effective at deterring people from crime.
Well, that's why the death penalty just doesn't really work, because no one's necessarily going to be scared of the death penalty if they're not scared of getting caught. Do you know what I mean? You don't need to think of the death penalty as an option. If you only got like a 1% chance of being caught, death penalty doesn't seem that bad, because that's only a 1% chance of being put in the chair.
Yeah.
You know? Like, so it really comes down to how good the police are at doing their jobs of catching criminals, which we all know how good the police are at doing their job of catching criminals. Not very good. Not very good at all.
I feel like this is maybe getting a bit idealistic, because the complexities of running a government and running a society are really tough when you actually try to put it into practice. But I feel like there are a lot of police, and a lot of them are doing sort of silly crimes, like people possessing marijuana, although mm-hmm. they don't do that very much anymore. But there are people like avoiding loads of tax and like stealing massive amounts of money.
Yeah.
And I feel like those are probably the, call me crazy, those are probably the things we should focus more on than like little stuff.
Are the people doing that white?
Oh.
Like just mostly.
Quite a lot of them, yeah.
No. Let's leave them at it. Leave them at it, and we'll focus on something else, like marijuana. Whatever black people are doing nowadays, you know.
what are they doing?
Well, they're doing marijuana at the same rate as white people
being arrested
at double the bloody in the US. But no, it's I kind of want to bring back to what you were talking about there, because that model wherein 10% of people get caught, right?
Yeah.
So they pay 10 times more than they should, you know, and that sort of part of the punishment.
Yeah.
That would be fine, I guess, to some degree, if there wasn't sort of a bias in who was caught. Because realistically, that 10% isn't just 10% of all speeders. It's some specific groups of people that speed, right? Like the police don't just willy-nilly, they don't just like close their eyes and throw a dartboard to decide, you know, which person they're going to go after, you know, which person they're going to let go. There is a lot of bias there, and we have the data to show that they over-police certain racial groups.
Even for speeding?
I'm not saying necessarily for speeding. Right, I'm just saying, I'm using that kind of as a jumping off point to talk about this. Because if you have 10% of, if you only have 10% of people being caught, how can you be sure that is, you know, a sort of accurate and fair 10% that represents the entire whole? Or, you know, how do you stop it from just making all of the sort of black people and all of the Latinos pay for crimes that everyone else is doing as well?
Because it feels almost like when you were talking about, well, how is it fair that the same, like, that people, if they have an impulse control problem, like, even if you take it much more extreme than ADHD, imagine you have an impulse control problem because of you had brain cancer and a portion of your brain had to be removed, or you know, or you have like a condition which means you don't have impulse control.
Mm-hmm.
It almost feels like, actually, if you do something like, I don't know, whatever crime, and you don't have an impulse control problem, you should be actually punished more.
Yeah, right. But then this is what we were talking about back then, which is how do we know that people actually are totally fine and just committing crimes because they want to?
It's impossible.
Surely, if you're committing a crime, there is something else going on, right? There's some other factor that has led you to doing that.
Well, yeah, and if you take a sort of causal view of the universe, which is that things have causes, and sort of that the idea that we have free will to make choices is sort of all part of the illusion of the causation of the universe, well, then, yeah, ultimately. And that's why I think sometimes things like pathologizing actually can be, it's almost like looking at society from a top-down view and going, okay, well, you know, pathologizing to a certain extent removes some of the agency from the person, because it says everything. If you pathologize everything, then it says everything is ultimately not the fault of anybody, because, you know, they were born with the genes they have and they had the childhood they have and everything. And, you know, we do generally put a line somewhere and go, okay, but eventually you take some responsibility.
Yeah.
But pathologizing looks at society from a top-down view, and it's not about going, well, let's absolve everybody of all responsibility for everything, but it's going, how do we just take, like, make stuff not happen as much?
Yeah.
Even, it doesn't matter whose fault it is, it doesn't matter what the causality is, let's just go, how do we affect the causality so that less crime happens?
Yeah.
That we all kind of do want that, and the model where we just put a bunch of random people in jail who we just happen to catch, like, that doesn't really seem to be working, because it's flipping loads of people in jail.
We still have crime. You know, like, you put more and more people in jail, and there's still tons of people out of jail doing the crimes. Probably jail is not working, or prison is not working.
And that's not to say that some form of, and we've talked about this in the past, where it's like, if somebody, whenever they're free, is grabbing an axe and running around attacking people, yes, you want to take that person away from people for a bit. Yeah. It's not to say that the function of taking somebody who is a danger to themselves or to other people and putting them in a different place where they can't access people for at least a while is a bad idea. It's a perfectly understandable idea. But the idea of going, as we've said, like, oh, you dreadful person, you think about what you've done for a very long time, like, that's very attractive to our monkey brains, but it doesn't actually seem to be doing what we want it to do.
Yeah, I mean, put it this way. Let's imagine that you and I have a child, let's say. We've got a child. Okay. We're raising our child, and our child does something naughty. They do something wrong. God. What is a better way to deal with this thing that the child has done wrong? Is it send them to their room? You don't really talk to them about what they've done wrong. You make them think about what they've done.
Withdraw affection.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or do you sit them down and talk about what they did wrong and say, hey, look, you did this. That's not okay for these reasons. You can't be doing that. And you find out what's going on with them, and you see if you can make up a strategy to make sure that that thing doesn't happen again. Which one do you think is more beneficial for you and the child and your relationship and the every relationship that the child has with everyone else?
It's obvious. Put them in a box and throw away the key. Makes my life easier. I got stuff to do, man. I haven't got time to have a conversation with someone that doesn't even have a prefrontal cortex yet. I'm a busy guy.
Okay.
No, well, yes, yeah, obviously. Yeah. Talking through, and that is a hard thing to do because I make a joke there, but the child doesn't have a fully formed prefrontal cortex yet. And so you have to talk to them on the level of understanding that they have. And that can be difficult because, and frustrating, I'm sure, because, you know, you're talking to like 10% of a human being, like 10% of a fully formed adult, or 20% of a fully formed adult, and it doesn't know any long words yet. And it doesn't necessarily have a fully formed sense of self yet. Mm-hmm. But yes, I feel like talking about stuff and going, what's going on? Even if it's on like very, you can figure it out. You can ask, you might not be able to figure it out, but yes, in summary, yeah, not put him in a box and throwing away the key.
Yeah, I mean, look, the reason that I'm saying this is because a lot of times when kids act out, it's because they don't know or they don't understand or they don't know how to deal with their feelings, right? Because I think we forget that children have big feelings too, and they don't have the same experiences that we have. Look, I've had a ton of experiences in my life, and I'm only 24 years old, okay? But at 10 years old, you've had way fewer experiences. So when something big happens and when something bad happens, it feels like the absolute end of the world. Like, I think we all remember being in high school and thinking that a test is the most important thing ever, or going to a party and not getting a kiss or getting a kiss or anything like that is the most important thing in the world. And now I genuinely cannot remember like any of the tests that I've taken in any detail, like how I did on them or anything like that. I can't remember, you know, stuff that happened at parties other than like the really big funny stuff. Like none of that is relevant to my life. But as a teenager, it was the most important thing. Think about that. And then think about a child who can't express themselves fully, who isn't like doesn't have their own autonomy, who, like, you know, is just kind of shipped around and doesn't have things explained to them all the time and has all these feelings that they can't express to other people and they don't understand themselves. And then suddenly they just get really gets too much and then they do something naughty. Well, then why would you just chuck them to a room? And kids are the same as everyone else. Yes, they're not fully formed, they're not fully developed, but sending someone to prison just because they've done something, you know, bad for society or wrong, it's not necessarily going to be helpful. You know, just sending them there and being like, lock you away, we're just going to leave you there, and then hopefully you'll learn your lesson. It's not going to work. Rehabilitation is the key. This is all about compassion for me, because I get it. It feels really good to lock someone up and throw away the key when we think they've done something bad, if they've stolen something, or even if they've committed murder. But I think people are almost always in some way redeemable. Like, people can always improve in some way. And sure, if you can't improve to the point of being safe around others, we can keep you elsewhere so that you can't harm anyone. But that doesn't mean having to keep you living below a poverty line. You know, you can have a nice life away from everyone else. Why don't you deserve a nice life away from everyone else just because, you know, you've got something going on in your head that means that you don't care about the sanctity of human life the way that other people do? You know, like, why should we value you less just because there's something?
Well, not that, even, you know, why should we? Why do we have the right to?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's the crucial. Oh, man, what I would give to restart life with like my fully formed brain, I'd be a billionaire by now. If I started life at 1 year old with my brain now,
and then
it grew the same way it grows from, I would be taking over the world.
I think about being an adult as I am now, back in high school, popping my brain in my body.
It's so infuriating, isn't it?
Because being a teenager, I don't think it's hard to realize this at the time, because you feel like the most complete version of yourself. You feel fully formed, and you feel like you know everything and you can take on the world. And this is not to sort of belittle teenagers, but I can't believe I thought what I thought as a teenager.
Yeah.
I would just love to pop my brain back into my teenage body in high school at some point and see how easy high school was, because high school is piss easy if you're an adult.
High school very horrible, actually, but more socially than the social part was really complicated and unpleasant, but the actual high school bit was fine.
What I mean is that high school is not necessarily a fun experience for teenagers, right? Mm. It can be really difficult in a number of ways.
Oh, I see.
But if you're in that environment as an adult, yes, surrounded by teenagers, you know, or an adult, yeah, brain and a teenager body surrounded by teenagers, it would be a lot easier, because the lessons that you've, yeah, learned through all those mistakes in high school, you don't need to make those mistakes anymore.
It's all about what you value.
Exactly.
And when you're a teenager, or when I was a teenager, and it sounds like when you were a teenager, you valued a lot of stuff that didn't actually ultimately lead to your happiness or, yeah, success.
Yeah. Yeah. Ding-a-ling-ling, is that the ad bell?
Oh, God, he won't stop ringing, will he?
Yes, well, he wants to tell us about SciGuys Live, Luke.
SciGuys Live?
Yes, SciGuys Live, the monthly live show where you and I, and sometimes a guest, talk about the science news and facts from the past month.
We also have a meme review where the members of our SciGuys Discord channel have made memes about the show, or just brought in external science memes and presented them to us. And at the end of the meme review, we crown a meme lord.
So if you want to be the meme lord and enjoy all the other fun of SciGuys Live, like the quizzes, the audience call-ins, and everything else, make sure you're around at the end of this month and every month for the rest of time.
On our YouTube channel.
Goodbye. No, wait, that's not right.
Back to the show.
Let's get back to the show.
If you insist.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
It's just, it's so interesting to think about how many changes occur throughout your life. But we should really be,
yes,
getting back,
sorry,
to ODD.
ODD.
So I was talking about the comorbidities. And as I said, ADHD is one of the most common comorbidities. You've got that occurring about 14 to 40% of children with ODD. And usually ADHD symptoms come before ODD symptoms. And this is.
Oh, sorry. Can I just check that?
Yeah.
ADHD symptoms come before ODD symptoms. Are you saying that ADD is visible? So ADHD is visible earlier than ODD is visible.
Usually.
But not necessarily that everyone has both.
Yeah, yeah. Not necessarily that everyone has both. But if you do have both, usually the ADHD symptoms show up first, right?
Yeah.
And I think that really highlights what's going on when it comes to ODD. And there are older studies that show sort of different things, and there's kind of an idea of there being maybe two different types of ODD that have different sort of roots, you know, that sort of lead to them. We'll get into those in a bit, but you know, we don't at this point know exactly what causes ODD. We could talk a little bit more about what we think in a sec. I just want to talk about the actual sort of diagnosis of it. So you can usually, you can find it in children as young as five. You can see those sort of problems or symptoms in kids as young as five, but usually they start presenting when they're at school age. And if you think your kid has ODD, there are a ton of hoops to jump through in order to get a diagnosis. They don't just hand them out willy-nilly. Like, as far as I'm aware, this seems to be a tough diagnosis to get. And, you know, they use sort of surveys. It's similar, I think, to sort of ADHD diagnosis, but I think probably more intense. You know, they've got surveys and different tests, and then, you know, the sort of medical professional will use their own experience as well to sort of determine whether a child has ODD or not.
Good question.
Yeah.
If you are seeking, you might not know the answer to this, if you're seeking a diagnosis for ODD, mm-hmm, for your child, mm-hmm, and then in the process of the diagnosis, we've talked in the past, a quick tangent, we've talked in the past about how, like, ideas like climate anxiety
yeah.
are sort of a ridiculous label, because we actually should be quite anxious about climate change because mm-hmm. it's going to get real bad. And so it's actually, it's not anxiety, it's a rational response. If you have a child with ODD and the home they live in is like extremely dysfunctional, would that mean that they might not be diagnosed with ODD?
I think they probably would still be diagnosed with ODD. Mm. So from what I've seen here, it says that risk factors are sort of like bullying or poor school performance. And other places say that there are sort of risk factors of, you know, dysfunctional family life. I think you could still get an ODD yeah. diagnosis. But then you see what I mean?
Because it doesn't really matter. You have ultimately become somebody with ODD.
Yeah.
Even though it's obvious why.
Yeah.
You still have become that thing. That's yeah. just the present day. That's what you are.
It's like you wouldn't be, just because you've got a dysfunctional home life, you wouldn't be held out of a depression diagnosis.
Yeah.
Although sometimes you are held out of a depression diagnosis if you're grieving, for example, before a certain period.
But that's because the diagnosis for depression will specifically say, if it's not better explained by something else, for yeah. example, grieving, recent loss, yeah,
exactly.
et cetera.
Exactly. I mean, it's the classic when it comes to these sort of diagnostic yeah. criteria. But yeah, no, there are a ton of different sort of risk factors. I mean, you know, if you've got learning disorders or intellectual problems, that can also play a role in the formation of this. And when they sort of, you know, give you the evaluation, there are multiple informants, it says here in this quote, I've got multiple informants, parents, siblings, friends, teachers, etc. So it can't just be in one, I think it can just be, sorry, in one environment, but I think the severity is based on how many environments it shows up in. That will make more sense in a second. Let's just go quickly through some of the diagnostic criteria. So I'm just going to read this out verbatim. It yeah. says, at least four symptoms from the list below should have been present on most days for at least 6 months, demonstrating a pattern of angry or irritable mood, argumentative or defiant behavior, or vindictiveness. So this list is as follows. Often loses temper, often touchy or easily annoyed, often angry and resentful, often argue with authority figures for children and adolescents with adults. Argue with authority figures or for children and adolescents with adults.
Yes.
So adults are all authority figures for children and adolescents here, right?
Yes.
This is, you can maybe see the picture
respect
I'm building.
Your elders.
Yeah, you can maybe see the picture I'm building of ODD here.
Yeah.
But we'll get to it. Often actively refuse or defy to comply with requests from authority figures or with rules. Often deliberately annoys others. Often blames others for his or her mistakes or misbehavior. The child has been spiteful or vindictive at least twice in the past 6 months. There should be evidence of impairment either in the form of distress in the individual, family, peers, etc., and or negative impact on social, educational, occupational, or other important areas of functioning. The behaviors do not occur exclusively during substance use, psychotic, depressive, or bipolar disorder. The patients must not meet the criteria for disruptive mood dysregulation disorder. And as I said, the severity is it is variable. So you've got mild symptoms if you only have it in one setting. If it's in at least two settings, it's moderate, and severe if it's in three or more settings. So those different settings could be home, school, and, you know, work
youth
or youth club, or, you know, different yeah. you know, different sort of, you know, social or, you know, home settings. And the causes, what do you think the cause of ODD is?
Trauma.
That's one potential cause. As I said, we don't necessarily know, yeah. but it's one of those things where
we don't know.
Yeah, we don't know exactly.
Okay.
Because, again, ODD is essentially just kids being defiant and, well, not just kids, but, you know, mostly diagnosed in kids, and usually they grow out of it. So it is sort of primarily in kids. So, yeah, it is generally just kids being defiant, or, you know, people not following rules or orders or not liking authority. And so when we try to find the
child?
One root cause of that, it can be difficult, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm just going to read out some of the risk factors they've got here, but it says that there could be a mix of biological, social, and psychological factors that could put kids at risk, and it can include poverty. Although it says, it specifies that ODD can occur in families of any economic status, but poverty, it makes sense why poverty might cause a child to be more defiant. You know, the stress of that, the trauma of maybe not getting enough to eat, of having parents that are, you know, constantly stressed because they are in poverty, and being poor is not a fun or easy thing to do.
Yeah.
You can have a parent with a mood, addictive, or behavioral disorder. That's a risk factor. Experiencing a traumatic transition, not being transed by those YouTubers.
Oh my gosh, I had this. I didn't talk to my dad for 2 years because I mean, he made us move from one part of the country to another part of the country whilst I had like a girlfriend of 2 years and all this stuff. And it turned out to be all right in the end, but
yeah.
I literally barely talked to him for 2 years. I called him Chris for several years rather than Dad.
And his name isn't even Chris. That's wild.
Yeah, right? Just changed his name. Yeah, so I mean, I definitely didn't have it to this level, but I did have, yeah, like you said, traumatic change. Like that was like, when I was 14, that was like my entire life was ending. Now, obviously, there are people who move a lot more than that, and that becomes fairly normal to them. But doing 14 years, the world was where I lived.
Yeah.
I didn't know about like the rest of the world, really, other than holidays and visiting my grandparents. And so, yeah, I became such a dickhead because I was very, very, very unhappy. I used to send him emails being like, I disown you as a father.
Jesus.
Yeah, it wasn't good. It was a really bad
period. I can imagine. Wow. Like, I mean, I think this is a good point to talk about how little we value teenagers' experiences. So earlier we were talking about how problems that teenagers have are just not that important through the eyes of an adult. And that's not to say that teenagers' problems aren't important at all. They feel big to teenagers. They don't feel big, you know, when you sort of grow out of them usually. But that doesn't mean that they're not important issues. So moving when you're 14 is like the end of the world.
Yeah.
And a lot of times adults, I think, have issues with interacting with teenagers because they forget the experience of being a teenager and they think, you're just being a dramatic teenager, you'll grow out of it. But that's such an unempathetic way to look at it.
Absolutely. I mean, the thing is like there's when we're, yeah, what we're laughing about like all the problems we experience as teenagers, we're talking about if I experienced that thing now, it wouldn't affect me in the way that it affected a teenager, me as a teenager. But the reality is like you've got to separate the objective and the subjective emotional experiences and something happening that it doesn't matter what you think of it objectively. What matters is the emotion, how much of a shock to the system it is and how much like that scars you emotion, like as an emotional trauma point in your life, which is a entirely subjective thing. Like I say, some people move around all the time during childhood, from early childhood, and then they're completely unaffected by it because they don't sort of, they maybe don't invest themselves in any one location anymore as much.
Well, you become used to it.
Exactly,
you know what I mean? Yeah.
Whereas, so things happening that adults think are not things, it's all about the subjective emotional trauma of it. And that actually is very big. And it has to be taken as seriously as a major traumatic event in an adult's life relative to an adult's brain.
Well, this is the thing. I think that a lot of the reasons that people have difficulty in raising teenagers, and I know that teenagers can be stubborn for seemingly no reason. I've had firsthand experience of that. But I think the massive, massive roadblock in actually connecting with teenagers is just that level of empathy of seeing their problems as important. Just because you think that they're frivolous, that doesn't mean that the teenager experiences them as that. As you're saying, it's that sort of like subjective emotional reality. But like all of our experiences are subjective. You know what I mean? Like, sure, to you, losing your house is a really big deal. But to someone else, it might not be. Who knows? You know, you can't base how much you value a problem on your own subjective viewpoint of what is a big problem, what isn't a big problem, right? Yeah. Because when you start doing that, you look at your subjective viewpoint as being objective, you're just setting yourself up for failure.
And if you go down that road, well, you can always then go, well, any problem you can experience in the Western world is nothing compared to something you can experience in the non-Western world.
Absolutely.
In areas where people are poorer. Not that the West's rich and everywhere else is poor. Obviously, I know that that's not the case.
Just like, speaking in general.
The old phrase, first world problems, it's like, well, pretty much any problem you experience. Oh, you lost your house? Oh, well, you still have a shop you can go to.
Yeah.
There's still running water. You can walk into any shop and ask for water. You any restaurant, ask for water. You have toilets. You have sanitation.
Yeah.
Food is brought to every high street in the entire country. Oh, man. Wow, you got problems, man? I had to walk 5 miles to get a jug of water today, and I carried it on my head.
Yeah, yeah.
And then my son was eaten by an animal.
Unrelated. But yeah, no, the thing is, yeah, experiences are subjective, and we shouldn't do that little sort of, ooh, oppression Olympics, ooh, I've got it worse than you've got it, all that sort of nonsense. And I kind of want to get back to the causes, because that's really what I wanted to talk about in regards to ODD. So it's pointed out, these papers that I've been reading, it pointed out that at least one study showed that ODD symptoms are worse in kids that struggle with peer acceptance in addition to family issues. And several studies link ODD to harsh, inconsistent, or neglectful parenting practices. So basically, when you look at the causes of ODD, we don't know what the main cause is, but from what I've picked up here, it seems that ODD is a label that we apply to kids who are unruly and who are defiant, for want of a better word. We apply that to them when they don't fit what we think they should be doing. And that's it. It's pathologized. They've got something wrong with them internally. What does that actually do to help? You know, there are treatments for it, but I don't know if just labeling kids that are, you know, disruptive as having ODD is necessarily the most beneficial way to deal with disruptive children.
I want to talk about this in the conclusion, actually, but I think this is really relevant here. I feel like the one thing that it does do, and it sort of links to our conversation about prison and things like that, is that by pathologizing something like this sort of behavior in children, what we do there is we, to a certain extent, absolve them of responsibility. I joked a lot at the start about, like, this sounds like the pathologizing of being a dickhead or the labeling of being a dickhead as a disorder. But that is the external appearance that you might think of somebody who has this, right? I'd be like, oh, that kid's a bit of a dickhead. And by applying a label to that and saying, oh, this is a disorder, whether it's a sort of actual classical disorder or a label for a set of observations, to a certain extent allows that child a break from responsibility, specifically because they're a child. Mm-hmm. If you see this sort of behavior in an adult, then you infer guilt, you infer agency, and you don't let them off. But because it's a child, you do. And the framework that we use for that sometimes is a disorder.
Yeah, I suppose. I think for me, having this as a disorder shows, I guess, the problems within parenting, right? If you're having trouble with your kid in this regard, and you then get the sort of ODD diagnosis, like, so often you see parents being like, oh, I'm at my wit's end, I don't know what to do. And a lot of parents are incredibly, incredibly harsh with their kids. Of course, you know, there's probably plenty of kids that have ODD that is kind of unrelated to the parenting style, you know, of their carers. But my point is that, you know, a lot of parenting styles nowadays are not necessarily healthy for children.
Oh my
gosh,
this reminded me, I was walking on the street the other day and I saw a mum pushing a little boy in a pram who was maybe like 3 or something, and he put his feet on the ground and then the pram sort of jolted and he fell out on the ground, and she just grabbed him and started yelling at him and shoved him back in the pram. And I was like, what? That's a child. What are you doing? I know that people's lives are stressful, I understand that, and I know that kids can be annoying as hell, but come on, man. It just made me really sad, because I was like, that's going to be really tough for that kid. If that kid has experienced that all the time, he's not going to grow up well. Like, there's just no way.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know the background. I don't know any of the context, obviously. But it's not going to not affect that child long term if that's going on all the time.
Well, one thing that's made me feel somewhat hopeful is, I guess, the sort of rise of gentle parenting. That seems to be coming about a lot more often now. So gentle parenting, I'm just going to paraphrase it. It's not giving any rules to your kids, but it's not shouting. And it's giving consequences that are sort of tied directly to the things that your kid does wrong. It's talking about their emotions and trying to find better ways of dealing with them. If your kid does something wrong, you say, hey, what's going on? Why did you do that thing? Hey, you've upset your brother by taking his toys when he was playing with them. Why couldn't you wait? Why didn't you play with another toy? What was going on there? And you find out, oh, well, the kid just wanted, you know, attention from his older brother, and that's why he did that. And then you find a way to say, okay, well, if you want that, then you just need to verbally say that, and if your brother doesn't do it, you can come to me and we can work it out. If your kid, you know, spills something, you don't send them to the room, you make them clean it up with you. You know, if your kid draws on the walls, you don't ground them and take away their internet access. You say, okay, you're going to help me clean this up. You know, like it's that kind of style of parenting where there's no shouting, there's no consequences that aren't directly tied to the transgressions. It's all about raising a kid that is emotionally healthy and understands, you know, understands that their actions have consequences and how to be sort of a good and nice person.
Yeah, this reminds me a lot of so this idea that when you're I mean, obviously we may be talking from, you know, if either of us have kids, we might be like, look at this episode, be like, wow, how naive.
Yeah, no, exactly. I know it's far more difficult than it seems. It's not easy at all.
But it reminds me of this sort of idea in psychology called transactional analysis. I'd love to do an episode on transactional analysis one day. I mean, I can do it, maybe.
Let's do it,
because I love it. I love transactional analysis. I trust you almost more to do the research and be objective about it, but... it's very interesting as a topic anyway. But it's this idea that when you are raising a child, this is not the specific idea of transactional analysis, but this is sort of what I take from it from a parenting perspective, is that when you're raising a child, you are forming the internal sort of voice of the eventual adult that you're raising. And if you raise a child to and you're constantly critical and angry and that kind of thing, then that child is going to grow up with an internal voice that is critical and angry. And I may be butchering this. I apologize if there's any psychology people listening. I'm sure we'll do a proper thing about it one day. But you're raising this eventual adult to have this horrible, vindictive, mean, traumatized internal parent that's going to be very harsh on the scared internal child that exists inside that parent's head. And it's a framework that's not necessarily literally true.
Yeah.
But you are that child is paying attention, and everything you do, the way you treat it, is being downloaded into their brain to mediate the behavior of the eventual adult.
Yeah.
And that is a massive responsibility.
I think what people forget, people think that, you know, you can do whatever with kids, they'll forget some stuff. You won't harm them too much.
You might forget it, but they won't forget the lesson.
My point is that you can't choose what a kid internalizes. And yeah. I'm not trying to shame parents that slip up or make mistakes or get frustrated or whatever. Like, you know what I mean? We're all humans, that's totally fine. My point is though that you can't choose what a kid internalizes. I remember offhanded comments that my parents made to me years ago that still affect me. And I'm not mad at them for it. Like, I'm not mad at my dad for this thing he said to me when I was like 7 years old, because he had no idea that I would still be thinking about it 17 years later. He just said it as an offhanded thing. And now I'm sitting here thinking, God damn it, why did he say that thing? What am I, how am I going to live up to this? How am I ever going to live? Like, you know what I mean? Like, it sticks there and it comes up every so often. And I think we need to be more conscious that children are people. They're people that are learning how to be people. They can't, and I've said this, you know, they can't necessarily verbalize or understand their emotions or how to deal with all of these different things and all of these new experiences, because there are so many new experiences when you're a kid. It must be so overwhelming, and no one takes you seriously. You don't have any autonomy. You don't get to choose what you do, when you go to bed, what to wear half the time. You know, you're constantly being told what to do. And that's a really tough thing to live under. And obviously, ODD isn't just parents being bad. That's not what I'm saying. But what I am saying is that maybe pathologizing children acting out isn't the best way to deal with children acting out. Of course, there are treatments for ODD. You know, you've got parent management training and school-based interventions, individual therapy, you know, like CBT. You've got pharmacological therapy using medications. So stimulants like are used in ADHD, which could maybe help control those impulses. All of those sort of things, they can help. But I think just grouping them under ODD in that way isn't necessarily helpful. By the fact that a ton of kids with ODD have ADHD, I think you're kind of pointing out that the reason that they have that presentation of ODD is because they're struggling with ADHD. The kid isn't the problem here. It's the environment that the kid is in. Like, I don't think a kid with ADHD is automatically going to be a disruptive, awful, terrible person to be around just because they have ADHD. I think maybe the environment that you put them in is going to have an effect on that. I mean, like, if you actually look into it, kids with ADHD end up growing up to have low self-esteem and all of these other things. Like, you have depression, anxiety, because you're living in a world that isn't built for you. And that makes sense to me as to why some kids could have, you know, ODD, because they're in an environment that is basically forcing them to be that way. And yes, having this disorder can be useful for a lot of people, but also I think it can be limiting by just looking at this complex human being who is acting in a way that society deems, you know, not acceptable. Just looking at them and being like, you fall into this category and we're going to deal with you the same as everyone else in this category. But maybe it's your parent's parenting style that's coming into it along with some trauma and, you know, internal emotional problems that you've got going on, you know? Like, it's so weird to me that ODD almost clearly seems to be a kid struggling to deal with other stuff. And we've got that as a disorder. There you go. We've pathologized a kid dealing with a difficult situation. There you go. It just seems so odd to me.
Great work.
Sorry. I had that in me this whole time. Yeah. I was waiting. I was waiting
to jump out, wasn't it?
Well, I think that's all I've got to say on it. I mean, is there anything else you want to talk about?
Well, I mean, yeah. No, I mean, I've sort of said what I wanted my conclusion to be, which is that I think I sort of, to a certain extent, stand by my opening reaction to this, which is that, I'll update my opening reaction to this, which is that the external appearance of somebody who might be classified as having ODD is that they look like they're a kid, right?
Yeah, that's fine to say.
That's the behavior. That's the behavior. That's how we would colloquially describe it uncharitably.
Yeah.
Is, oh, that kid's a bit of a kid. And then, but what I think is so important is having some type of system or categorization which absolves a child of responsibility to a certain extent, especially when their behavior is a response to a trauma or to a difficult situation in some kind, or having ADHD or something like that. And that doesn't have to be done by pathologizing it. You can have phrases like, but they're a child.
See, this is, I think we agree, but in different ways.
Different directions.
Yeah, different. We're agreeing in different directions because I agree that it's good to take the onus of the reactions off of the child, because the child has almost no control over their life, and we cannot expect children to act, you know, as adults would, or to, you know, respond to things perfectly or to deal with all of these emotional problems really well. Kids need a ton of support, especially when they're going through something difficult. But what I think is that we don't need to pathologize something to absolve someone of all, like, you know, of some level of responsibility for that. We can just do that with compassion instead. What I mean by that is when I was saying, yeah, it's probably fine to say, yeah, they externally appear to be dickheads, because we say dickhead to have sort of an intent behind it, right? But I think if you're saying dickhead in the context of, no, I'm not saying that you're intentionally being a dickhead, or that you're choosing to do that, or it says anything about you.
I'm going to say that to somebody next time they're a dickhead. But, I'm not saying you're deciding to be a dickhead.
Yeah.
But you are behaving like a dickhead.
No, exactly. But exactly, right? Like, my point is that there doesn't need to be intent there. You don't need to sort of, you don't need to say, okay, you're acting this per way, and that reflects poorly on your character.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's complex. People can act in a way that is not, you know, that is not socially sort of, you know, it's not conducive to good social interaction with others.
Yeah.
And it could be kind of out of their hands to some degree. And look, you can hold them responsible, and you could say, look, here's what you can do to help this. But it doesn't do well to be like, okay, you're acting poorly, terrible person, you're irredeemable, unless you've got a diagnosis, you know?
Yeah, I don't entirely agree about the pathologizing. I think that in some cases, in some situations, the pathologizing can be very helpful. I think it allows the designing of systems. Because you're dealing with people, like, you sound like you're talking like a very empathetic person. And there aren't, not all people are as empathetic as you are. And also, a lot of people are very busy, and you need to design systems that hold up to enormous amounts of pressure, like school systems. And so, you know, having a label that's like, okay, this person has passed this test of ODD, and this means that a teacher, no matter how empathetic or unempathetic they are, is not allowed to behave in this way. They have to allow a greater degree of, they have to make greater allowances than they maybe want to, based on their level of empathy that they describe. And then it allows you, like I say, to create systems and structures and like procedures in order to make something official that allows for differences in the adults implementing that system.
I don't disagree with you on that. So I want to just clarify my position. I'm not saying that pathologizing is inherently bad in all instances. I understand the value of pathologizing things because it's one of the only ways that we can get things to work in this system that we've got. My only issue with pathologizing, you know, that kind of behavior in children is that in some ways it can sort of hide what is actually causing that behavior. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
So if you say, oh, you've got ODD and that's why you're acting this way, you just write it off as the kid sucks when the parenting style
could... He is broken.
Yeah. The parenting style could be causing a... Yeah. Or they could be broken.
They are broken.
Or Z, whatever pronouns. My point is that it could be something that, you know, that is to do with the parenting style.
Yeah.
Or a problem at home or something that is kind of external to the child that could be dealt with. And by saying, you know, kids that act like this, you've got ODD... It is something going on inside of you. It doesn't really seem to help, especially given that, you know, a lot of people grow out of it, and not necessarily just grow out of it, but, you know, get over it by the time that they're 18. That kind of, to me, highlights that this isn't something internally wrong with a kid. This is a kid struggling to be able to cope with whatever's going on and therefore not respecting authority figures. Which, like, it's very weird to me as well that in the diagnostic criteria there, it was saying that, you know, for children or adolescents, being like that to adults is enough. Not all adults should be authority figures.
Yeah, so what happens if the authority figures are themselves kids?
There you go, right? But yeah, look, my point is that pathologizing can be useful in some contexts, but the problem with it is that it eliminates nuance to some degree. Yeah. And that is my take on this.
Hey!
Well, that is the end of this. I do have one more thing to do.
Oh, dear.
It's a quick fire quiz.
Dun, 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 dun. Odd edition.
So the rules for the quick fire quiz are the same as they always are when it's just you, Luke. I'll ask one question. That's just one question for you. And if you get it right, what do you win?
Nothing.
You're gosh darned right. And if you're listening at home or if you're watching over on YouTube, you can play against Luke. If you manage to answer the question before Luke does, then you beat Luke. No buzzers, just answer it first.
Let me know in the comments if you beat me.
Remember, you can't answer until I've finished asking the question, and here it is. What disorder shares a high comorbidity with ODD?
I know the answer.
What is the answer?
The answer is ADHD.
Ding, ding, ding. You are correct. Let us know in the comments if you beat Luke this week. But before we go, we'd like to thank all of our patrons with a very special thank you to executive producers Danito and Glitch Rabbit. And thank you for listening. You can find the full references for this episode in the description. Subscribe for new episodes every Monday. And why not leave us a nice week review? You can support the pod at patreon.com/SciGuys. Or you can find and contact us at SciGuysPod on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and at SciGuys on TikTok. Or you can send us an email at SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
That's SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
We need to develop a harmony.
Yeah, I did not know what I was doing there.
We'll get Dodie on it. Harmonize this small sting we made for our podcast.
That'll be £1,000. You can follow me at NotCory everywhere.
You can follow me at LukeCutforth everywhere.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling Yuzu Mango IQ Mix Hydration Mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to iqbar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's iqbar.com, promo code KELLER20.